Hi, I'm Marco Werman. All of us in the newsroom are used to being on deadline, and right now is no exception. We are officially in the home stretch before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Many listeners in the last few weeks have responded with words of encouragement and, yes, financial support. I can't tell you how much it means to all of us. Take this note from a listener named Phyllis. Thank you so much for your creation and contributions, she writes. A huge contribution to world understanding. Much needed. Thank you, and warm good wishes. Thank you so much, Phyllis. Join Phyllis and so many other listeners by going to theworld.org/give and make your gift today. Time is running out before June 30th, so please don't wait. That's theworld.org/give, or check out the link in our episode notes. Thank you again, and be well.
Fifty people are dead after being abandoned in a tractor trailer in the Texas heat. Unfortunately, it's not a new phenomenon.
This is not the first time that a tragedy like this has happened. Maybe the magnitude has, you know, shocked us.
We look at how these human smuggling operations work. And in Lebanon, electricity is in short supply, so the solar industry is one of the few that's booming.
So every Tom, Dick, Harry, Mohammed, Hussein, Joseph, everybody around the block is an expert on solar energy now.
Except when those so-called experts actually aren't. I'm Carol Hills. In Iraq, parliament changes hand, and Iran now has more influence than ever.
This is the most important, high-profile, cataclysmic political event that nobody outside of the Middle East has ever heard of.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us today. There's big news today from the NATO summit, which just kicked off in Madrid. Turkey will no longer block Sweden and Finland's bids to join the military alliance. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made the announcement late today.
I'm pleased to announce that we now have an agreement that paves the way for Finland and Sweden to join NATO.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine prompted Sweden and Finland to apply to join the alliance, but Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had blocked the move, saying the two Nordic countries were friendly to rebel groups that Turkey considers terrorists. Now the three countries have signed a joint agreement resolving the question, so a big first day at the Madrid summit. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more on what to expect as the summit continues this week.
More than 10,000 police and security personnel have descended on the Spanish capital as leaders from across the world arrived in Madrid today. On Sunday, a few thousand anti-NATO protesters took to the streets, calling for an end to the military alliance. But this week's summit is all about expanding the group. Here's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg speaking earlier today.
We will transform the NATO response force and increase the number of our high readiness forces to well over 300,000.
That's up from 40,000 right now. Baltic nations that share a border with Russia will be happy with the news. They've been calling for more NATO troops on the ground in Eastern Europe for months now. Estonia's Prime Minister said recently her country could be wiped off the map if Russia invaded. Lithuania's ambassador to the UK, Renatas Norkus, tells me he's more optimistic than that.
We have strengthened our defense already quite substantially. We have the NATO troops on the ground. And most importantly, we have the will to defend ourselves. And Ukraine has demonstrated that it is possible to keep even the stronger enemy at bay.
The summit will also draw up what's known as a new strategic concept. It's basically a mission statement, laying out NATO's goals and challenges for the next 10 years. The last plan, ratified back in 2010, named Russia as a key strategic partner. Not anymore, says Jens Stoltenberg.
I expect it will make clear that allies consider Russia as the most significant and direct threat to our security.
Robert Bustel remembers that 2010 mission statement well. He was stationed in Moscow as head of the NATO Information Office, and he spent a lot of his time fighting back against anti-NATO propaganda. Today, he says, some of the worst propaganda comes straight from the Kremlin and the country's foreign minister.
I thought I've heard everything. Well, Mr. Lavrov, a couple of days ago, accused, no less, NATO and European Union of being in collusion in order to prepare a war against Russia and compared to organizations to the Nazi Germany.
Pichel spent 5 years in the job. Today, the office no longer exists in Moscow. I ask him if he thinks he failed at his job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I want to sort of engage in self-flagellation, sure, I can agree with your conclusion that, you know, I did not make a difference. The problem is, however, that at some point it became apparent it's just not going to be a partner. On the contrary, it is a problem and, you know, now it's become an existential threat.
That threat from Russia is expected to dominate this week's two-day summit. The summit isn't all about Europe, though.
China is going to make a very large appearance in this strategic note, and it shouldn't be lost on anyone that we have multiple non-NATO members attending the summit from the Indo-Pacific region.
Charles Edel is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Australia, South Korea, Japan, and New Zealand are all going to Madrid too. Edel says their main concern will be China and its increasing use of military aggression across the Indo-Pacific. And he says China's influence in Africa will almost certainly come up.
Frankly, the fact that Madrid is hosting and that they have said that they are specifically focused on Africa because it is so close to Spain. And then I think that, well, there will be discussions about China's expanding influence and reach within Africa and discussions about what the NATO countries might be able to do about that.
But the most immediate challenge facing the world leaders is how NATO plans to support Ukraine and surrounding Eastern European countries without risking an all-out war with Russia. Former NATO diplomat Robert Pichel says it's a risk the alliance has to consider.
We have to do, as NATO, what is necessary to defend in a credible way the alliance against the threat that Russia is posing. You know, the truth is that if we are better configured, if we have the better, more credible forward defense, then that acts as a deterrent.
Today's decision by Turkey to drop its veto on Sweden and Finland joining the alliance is a big achievement for NATO. But there'll be plenty of tough decisions to be made over the next 2 days. And getting agreement from all member states will not be easy. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
50 people are dead after being abandoned in a tractor trailer in the Texas heat. Over a dozen other migrants were saved from the trailer in San Antonio yesterday and hospitalized for heat-related illnesses. Authorities say this is among the deadliest known outcomes of a human smuggling operation across the U.S.-Mexico border. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says he hopes those responsible are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
The plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy.
Joining us now is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera. She's a public policy professor at George Mason University in Virginia. Guadalupe, 50 people have died as of this afternoon. Others have been hospitalized. This is not the first time a tragedy like this has happened. Can you put this into context for us?
Absolutely. This is not the first time that a tragedy like this has happened. Maybe the magnitude has, you know, shocked us. But in the year 2017, in the same city, 10 migrants died inside a trailer. And that is not the only event that we have had. Cars trying to cross the border when law enforcement has tried to stop them, or there are other operations through the sea. Also, we have seen dozens, maybe hundreds of people dying when they are trying to cross the Sonora-Arizona borders through the desert of Arizona. Or through the Falfurrias County in Texas, they walk, they stay in stash houses in different cities of Texas or Mexico at the border, and they walk with the help of a guide, also part of a migrant smuggling operation. So there are so many ways that migrants lose their life in accidents or trying to escape from law enforcement.
Where are the smugglers themselves from?
That is an important question. We are talking about migrant smuggling networks. Therefore, the ones that operate at the border. In this case, we see guides. We see guides that can be Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, or people born and raised in the United States. But these migrant smuggling operations involve people from different parts of the world. Usually migrants, their initial part of the journey connects them with people from their own countries. So we're not just talking about people from Central America. We're talking about people from Brazil, from Haiti, from Cuba. And when we are talking about what is happening, we usually see that they are with a driver, but the drivers are just part of the network. So it's difficult to say who is in charge of running this migrant smuggling operation. We know that, for example, in the year 2017, the only person that was focused on as part of the investigation was the driver of the 18-wheeler. And the driver of the 18-wheeler was a U.S. citizen. And that's something that does not matter so much because, as I said, when we see that there's one person in charge of leading the migrants, we're just seeing a guide. We're not understanding the network. Who is really leading that network? It's not a Central American migrant or a Central American citizen most of the time when we are talking about operations at the border. When we talk about operations at the border, they live in Mexico or in the United States, but usually we are seeing just guides, Mexican-Americans or American citizens.
Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. have already accused each other. They say each group's immigration policies have led to these circumstances. What connection do you see between U.S. immigration policy and human smuggling at the border?
Well, the limitations with regards to legal migration, the lack of legal pathways when there is availability of jobs, that is what causes the growth and the existence of migrant smuggling networks that facilitate human mobility or the access of the people who are in need of these jobs in the United States. We're mainly talking about economic migrants when we're thinking about this. Of course, there are so many people that cannot live in their places of origin because of violence, because of a number of reasons that push them from their countries. They are in search of a better life, and that life can be given in the United States.
Among migrants who are trying to reach the U.S., are there warnings and information that they pass along to one another about the risks of getting involved with smugglers and coyotes?
Absolutely. But they are making the choices based on cost and effectiveness. And even though they understand the risk, they understand the challenges, and they understand the dangers, they still want to make it because they know once they cross the checkpoint, once they are in the United States, they're going to have a better life. So they are willing to maybe die. It's a possibility. Many of them know that others die. Many others know that women are raped, and women are even conscious about that, take pills to give birth of children.
Morning after pills.
Exactly.
You've studied this issue. How do we prevent these kinds of awful things from happening, of migrants dying in container trucks?
There are a number of causes of this phenomena, pull and push factors, bad policies, lack of legal pathways, legal pathways for regular migration. And at the same time, we have the root causes of migration, poverty, inequality, violence, and, you know, a very unequal system overall in the world, a global economic system. So we need to address the different causes of these. The dismantling of migrant smuggling networks is also very important. Investigation about who is doing this, who is taking advantage of this, and fixing of the immigration system and the developed world that is broken. The existence of jobs that, you know, and these incentives.
Are there short-term things that could really prevent this kind of thing from happening?
Short-term would be the dismantling of migrant smuggling networks, investigation, collaboration to deal with this and to prevent people to deal with the migrant smugglers. But we're not going to solve this with law enforcement. We have to deal with the root causes of undocumented migration. We have to deal with poverty, inequality, violence, all that has to be done at the same time. There's not only a way to deal with this, to prevent this from happening, because if law enforcement, try to dismantle these networks, there's going to be advances, but they are going to be changing their strategies. And if there is demand, there's going to be a supply.
Guadalupe Correa Cabrera is a professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thanks for speaking with us, Guadalupe.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, a very small satellite with a pretty big mission to the moon. Plus, why participating in the Hajj this year has suddenly become pretty frustrating for Muslims traveling to Saudi Arabia. We'll explain just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Every year, millions of Muslims travel to Saudi Arabia to perform the Hajj, a sacred pilgrimage and a pillar of the Islamic faith. This year, the Saudi government changed the rules for applying for a visa for the Hajj just a month ahead of its start next week. That's making it much harder for Muslims coming from the U.S., Europe, and Australia. To tell us more, we're joined by Sean McLaughlin. He's studied the Hajj for decades and is a professor of the anthropology of Islam at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. Sean, how have the visa application rules changed this year?
Well, there's been a big change this year from a system where pilgrims bought their packages, including visas, from agents in their home countries. There were often long chains of buying and selling packages, and sometimes this led to fraud. So people didn't always get what they paid for. So that's been the system since around 2006. What's happened now at very late notice is that whole system of buying and selling packages has moved online. So the only way of getting your package and visa is through a new online travel agent called Mutawif.
And that's a Saudi online travel agent?
Yes, it's accredited by the Ministry of Hajj, so a government department, and operated by the company that usually looks after some aspects of delivery of services out in Saudi Arabia, but not key aspects of those packages, including flights and hotels and just generally taking care of people.
Do we know why the Saudi government made these changes and why they did so at the last minute?
They have been developing the Hajj industry, the pilgrimage industry per se, and they want to modernize it. So moving online to a more centralized system, a simpler system, makes a lot of sense. They want to use technology to try and address operational matters and the delivery of services.
That makes sense, but why make the decision so late in the game?
There's a pattern of the Saudi authorities making decisions very late, and this is what people can't really understand, at least in terms of the consumer's point of view. So it seems rather thoughtless. Certainly the system that they've put live hasn't been trialed. There are so many technical glitches. So this question of why it's been done so late is what's perplexing everybody.
How many pilgrims make the Hajj each year?
If we look back at the last decade, around 2.5 million pilgrims have traveled every year. During COVID, that's been scaled back very considerably. This year, where we're looking at 1 million pilgrims, that's a move back towards normality for the Saudis.
So what are people left with? Are they losing their money? Are they applying to the new website and waiting to hear? How's it working?
What we've seen is some people not yet get decisions on whether they've been selected. Other people have actually managed to select packages, but they discovered later on in the process that those packages weren't available. Some people managed to pay, but then got failed booking notices. And most recently, we've had people going to the airport, but without tickets being issued. And they've had to find all sorts of workarounds to try and communicate with airlines. Some people have been turned away at airports. And I know that some pilgrims in North America have been having difficulty because they need to take internal flights. And they've been taking those flights or had those flights booked before they've actually had confirmation that they're good to go.
Sean McLaughlin is a professor of the anthropology of Islam at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
NASA today launched a microwave-sized satellite to scope out a special pathway around the moon. The agency has big plans for this pathway, including eventually launching a lunar space station to orbit the moon and bring back the days when astronauts walked on its surface. Here to tell us about the new mission, called Capstone, is its project manager, Elwood Agassiz. Elwood, this sounds like a really small satellite. Describe it for us.
You can literally place this spacecraft on your kitchen table or your kitchen counter. That's the size of the spacecraft. It's an adaptation of what's called a CubeSat. And that was something that was developed by the universities to use as an education tool at first, but also as a research tool to train students in aerospace technologies and aerospace missions.
How do you launch a satellite as small as a microwave oven?
The comparison in size, I mean, it's a huge rocket. So it's the traditional launch, right? And it has boosters. It's a two-stage rocket. And in this case, it's being launched out of New Zealand at the Rocket Lab Launch Complex 1 facilities in Mahia, New Zealand.
And so once it's up there, what's it going to do? It's small. What is it capable of?
So one of the things it's going to do is it's going to fly in this orbit called a near rectilinear halo orbit, which is basically a stable orbit that does not require a lot of propulsion. It's a very highly elliptical orbit. At its highest point, it'll be around 70,000 kilometers above the moon. And at its lowest point, it'll be somewhere between 1,000 to 2,000 kilometers at its lowest point above the moon. It has nearly unobstructed a view of the Earth, which optimizes communication between the Mission Operations Center on Earth and the Gateway.
How will this space station differ from previous ones?
Well, one, it's going to be around the moon, and it'll be a little bit smaller than our existing International Space Station. That will be a good launch point for the astronauts to arrive at the space station. And then if they will start to do any research on the moon, then the astronauts would go from the space station down to the lunar surface. So it's an easy transition point, and it allows the astronauts to, you know, deliver scientific equipment to the lunar surface and then also return it to space station.
I think some people would think, oh, we already know about the moon. What do we still want to learn about the moon?
They want to be able to understand, you know, extended duration missions on the moon when, you know, humans transition and go to Mars and do other deep space research. Being able to manufacture and live on the moon and look for resources like water, other types of resources that could be used for manufacturing, and also do extended duration missions, much like what they do on the International Space Station, but do it on the lunar surface.
Is this in some ways a warm-up for a Mars mission?
Well, they'll definitely use what they learn. Environmental conditions will differ, and then the transit time to Mars will be longer. So extended stays in the lunar gravity will help educate folks so that they can learn, you know, what it's like. The other thing that they'll be looking at is the impact of radiation in the lunar environment as well, and to see how that might apply to, you know, long transit missions going to Mars.
Elwood Agassiz is Deputy Program Manager for NASA's Small Spacecraft Technology Program and the Project Manager for the Capstone Mission. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time.
You're listening to The World. Language tells part of the story of who we are. In Florida, Haitian immigrants are preserving theirs, including this mom.
That's what I am trying to teach my kids right now, the background of being a unique and appreciate your culture.
A new Duolingo course to keep people connected to their mother tongue. Also, what to look for at this week's NATO summit, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. As NATO leaders gather for a summit in Madrid this week, their focus, of course, is the war in Ukraine. NATO countries have paid close attention to how the war is being fought, the strategies being used, and the strengths and weaknesses of Russia and Ukraine. Dara Masico is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation who focuses on defense and security issues in Russia and Eurasia. Dara, the type of war that's being fought in Ukraine's east now is different from what we saw in the first few months. How has it changed?
In the first few months, we saw Russia really advancing quickly, outrunning their logistics, facing several attacks in their rear lines from Ukrainian forces. And now we're settling into more positional warfare, grueling fights for small villages and small cities, with a lot of artillery strikes on both sides. It's a very casualty-heavy type of war fighting.
I'm also wondering how you think the changes that you're seeing on the battlefield in Ukraine, how they're affecting how the U.S. military and NATO forces think about how they should be operating in the future.
Sure. I think there's a lot of lessons learned here. Even weapons that are not thought to be particularly sophisticated, like Stingers, can really have a pronounced impact if your adversary is not taking appropriate precautions. I've been surprised to see how many types of advanced aircraft have been subject to these kind of issues, and on the ground as well. Also, I think there's a lot of battlefield adaptation that's going to take a lot of time to study.
And how might this impact NATO forces down the line? What are they kind of digesting about what they're observing in Ukraine?
Looking forward from this war, thinking about different ways or more efficient ways of defending against an armored invasion group. It might not necessarily be tank heavy. It might be something more defensive, something that is more affordable to defend against that. And that would be in your traditional kind of Baltic defense scenario. And I think also what happens to the Russian military after this conflict, they have taken significant losses in materiel and personnel. What does that mean for conventional deterrence and Russia's ability to conventionally wage war moving forward?
How would the fact that the weaknesses of Russia's military are kind of being laid bare in this conflict, how does that influence NATO and U.S. forces moving on?
There's a few different ways to think about this. One, what Russia's doing is inherently pretty difficult to do. The territory that they are occupying right now in Ukraine is a very large country. It's roughly from New York City stretching down into like the Richmond, Virginia, Charlottesville area, if you were to overlay Ukraine on a map of the United States. So it's a very long front line. Not a lot of militaries can do that. I don't know that ours could do that at this point in Europe, but you know, there's a lot of those kind of force posture decisions that have to be made. But the other thing, looking at Russian attrition and grinding down some of its military in this conflict in Ukraine, I think what that means is that a lot of Russia's conventional warfighting capabilities, whether it's missiles, whether it's tanks, whether it's the soldiers themselves, a lot of those things are gone now. So what does that mean for the nuclear threshold? If there was ever a conflict between Russia and NATO, is that nuclear threshold now closer? Because they don't really have the type of flexibility that they wanted to have anymore now that they have essentially shot 2,000 plus missiles into Ukraine. They don't have those options anymore. So in one sense, conflict then moves farther away. But if it were ever to happen, that conventional deterrence is essentially eroded at this point.
Now, going back to the NATO summit, you know, NATO's been clear from the start, no boots on the ground. But at the same time, what are NATO's options regarding the war in Ukraine?
Well, I think we're seeing the limits being set for the support that they're providing. I mean, you see NATO leaders talking about any number of things that they can do to support, whether that's armor on the ground, whether it's life support functions, you know, like medic kits, things like that. The United States is providing financial assistance to the Ukrainian government. Intelligence support is being provided in some way. So this is a pretty significant policy shift from what we previously had in 2014 when those things were not present. So I'm surprised that Russia didn't assume that this was possible. The Russians made, I think, a faulty assumption that the West would not come to Ukraine's aid.
Finally, there seems to be consensus among military observers and experts that this war will drag on for a long time. Do you agree with that assessment, or do you think at least a ceasefire might be possible?
So, you know, I'm looking at what Russia thinks that it's going to be able to achieve at this point. And from the force laydown that they have, the types of sources of personnel that they can draw from internally to Russia, and the types of decisions they're making about eastern Ukraine, to me, they seem to think that they will be able to control Luhansk, Donetsk, maybe the region of Zaporizhia, and maybe the area of Kherson. Like, they're already making plans to integrate the internet into the Russian internet, different types of telecommunications, these kind of things. They think that they can achieve that. My concerns are that they will try to annex those four regions of Ukraine in the months ahead and declare them as part of the Russian Federation and hope that that stops the fighting. Ukraine is unlikely to accept that. So for the next few months, Russia is going to be trying to get to those goals and then firm up those lines and then just sit there. So this is either a frozen conflict, very expensive one for Russia to try to maintain, But yes, I agree with you. I think this is going to be ongoing. And even if this active phase of the conflict stops, I don't think that Russia has achieved the strategic goals that they set out to do. It's not over yet.
Dara Masico is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. She's been speaking with us about the war in Ukraine and some of the lessons learned by the U.S. and NATO. Thanks a lot, Dara.
Thank you for having me.
Lebanon is facing an unprecedented financial crisis. The country has gone bankrupt, and electricity and running water are largely unavailable. Residents have long plugged the gap with private water deliveries and generators. But as the price of fuel skyrockets, more people are turning to another solution, solar power. Dori Buscarin has this report from Lebanon.
It's pickup time at this daycare center in Lebanon's sunny Bekaa Valley. As you walk inside, the lights are on, and luxuriously, so is the air conditioning. A few months ago, Salma Sauter Qasem and her husband sank their savings into solar panels. For this daycare that she runs, for their house, and for the vineyard they own nearby. Through a translator, she says she was fed up with the city's power supply, which only provides a couple of hours of electricity every day. I need to keep food in the fridge. I need hot water, Qasem says. Now I have electricity 24 hours a day. I don't have to worry. There are still adjustments to make. The panels generate the most electricity between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. That's when she runs the washing machine, the dishwasher, the vacuum cleaner. My lifestyle is based on the sun, Qasem says. I don't know what the future holds, but I know this energy is mine, that I created. But privately, she worries. Is she enabling the Lebanese government by adapting to its inability to provide electricity? Does that just make it worse for other people? Lebanon imports 97% of its fossil fuels. And until last year, the Lebanese government used this fuel to provide most of the country with 18 hours of electricity a day. Fuel subsidies helped people pay for private generators to plug the gap, says Rani Karam of the Lebanese Foundation for Renewable Energy.
Now you're running out of electricity. The country is almost in total blackout. You have 1 or 2 hours every day. The diesel generation is the costliest way of producing electricity.
And it's working people who suffer the most, he says. Just 2 years ago, Lebanon produced a mere 70 megawatts of electricity from solar. But in the past 2 years, that number has almost quadrupled, largely driven by small residential projects.
So anybody who can afford installing solar now is doing so.
Lebanon's power grid isn't well equipped for residential solar, so people use systems that are self-contained. They deploy a rechargeable battery to cover nighttime hours, rather than use municipal power. These systems aren't cheap. Most residential packages start at around $2,500 and go up to $14,000. But stand on any rooftop in Lebanon's capital city, Beirut, and you'll see the panels, wide, set at an angle, capturing energy from the sun. On fancy hotels and modest family homes alike, attached to overhead lighting along the highway. Business is booming. But even the ones benefiting have concerns.
Solar energy is the only business that is happening in Lebanon now. So every Tom, Dick, Harry, Mohammed, Hussein, Joseph, everybody around the block is an expert on solar energy now.
Sari Bouabdallah is the business development manager for Sokotel Zinshine, a Lebanese joint venture with a Chinese solar panel maker. Most panels in Lebanon now are made in China. Abdullah says that this year he's seen a proliferation of fake companies, fake licenses, even people with no training who claim they can install solar panels now.
The mounting structure must resist wind speeds of 120 kilometers per hour. But you see all these guys, they're coming and they're installing, they're just putting bolts, they're trying to cut corners here and there. The systems are catching fire because the thickness of the cable that they are using, it is not thick enough. Let when the winter comes and wind speeds comes, my fingers are crossed that the panels will not fly away.
This is probably happening because the demand for affordable solar is so high, while fewer Lebanese can manage the cost amid the country's currency crisis. Joseph Asaf, a server at a local restaurant, says he was looking at a $7,000 system for his family's home some time back.
Yeah, and the dollar was a bit low, then a week later, the dollar went crazy up. So alas, we forgot about the whole thing. Yeah.
Asaf says it felt like a risk anyways. What if the panels had needed repair or gotten damaged in a storm? What if Lebanon's electricity crisis subsides?
It's unfair that we have to install solar panels and wait for the sun and, you know, be economic with our electricity, which is our basic human rights.
Until something gets worked out, he's stuck with the rising cost of generator fuel or a life lived by candlelight. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin in Beirut.
As a language, Haitian Creole hasn't always gotten the respect it deserves. Through popular culture and education, Haitian Americans are changing how the language is regarded, at least in the U.S. A new Duolingo course for Haitian Creole has its origins in Florida among Haitians in the diaspora who worry about being disconnected from their family's mother tongue. From WLRN in Miami, Wilkin Brutus tells us more in this love letter to Haitian Creole.
Haitian comedian Sid Jewell said you can speak any language you want, but don't leave Haitian Creole behind. This is from his Amazon Prime comedy special.
Mou ka pale nipot lang ouvle. Plis lang ou pale, plis li bon pou. Me Creole la, pa mette l'deye.
Because Haitian Creole is a language with a revolutionary past.
This is the language that allowed enslaved people to unite and create a nation and stake a claim right after the French Revolution, right after the U.S. Revolution, and say, all folks have a right to human dignity.
Naya Flores Toussaint is a Haitian-American linguistic scholar. He went to Florida International University for his undergrad. Toussaint worked alongside an FIU professor to create a Haitian Creole curriculum.
Language not only tells the present story of what we're saying, but by the words we choose and by the grammar that we have made, it tells a much larger story of who we are.
For many second or third generation Americans, the children and grandchildren of immigrants, the larger story of who we are can get lost.
I didn't have that background because I was born in New Jersey to a Haitian mother and grandmother that had been in New Jersey since 1976. And so though people in my house spoke Creole, Creole wasn't taught to us.
He realized other people might not have an accessible way of learning the language.
It literally was a cold call to Duolingo on LinkedIn. Hey, could we partner to do this? Because this is more than just a course to learn for fun. This is something that has sociological backing and will make a huge impact on the people of Haiti and all of those who are interested in Haiti.
It didn't take much convincing. Toussaint says the Duolingo course allows English speakers to connect with Haitian values, culture, spirituality, history, and language. It includes more than 100 lessons on how to use vocabulary and abbreviations, differences in grammar and conjugation, and the throat and nasal sounds you make when pronouncing words in Haitian Creole.
Bonsoir, y'a mangé diri?
Ou manger diri.
Duolingo partnered with Haitian restaurants in Miami to promote the new language course. Advertisements at local bus stops urged people to practice their Haitian Creole at those spots.
Curry sauce and a tomato sauce. We sauteed a shrimp.
Jeanette Derelis is a cook at Manger Restaurant at the Citadel near Little Haiti.
My background is a Haitian Bahamian. I was born in the Bahamas. My parents, both of my parents, is Haitian.
I ask Derelis for extra banan pizzi and piclis, their fried plantains and spicy fermented coleslaw. We spoke English and Haitian Creole, and I noticed that her accent, when she speaks English, sounds a bit different than Haitian immigrants in the U.S. typically do.
I'm married to a Haitian. I have three kids. And then they are Haitian Bahamian. My dad, unfortunately, passed away. But that's what I am trying to teach my kids right now, the background of being a unique and appreciate your culture.
The Haitian diaspora expands far beyond the U.S. The top three languages spoken in the Bahamas, for example, are English, Bahamian Creole, and Haitian Creole. A Creole language is often derived from multiple other languages, like French, English, Spanish, or Portuguese. Derelis said she had to make a strong effort to maintain her cultural and linguistic identity while assimilating into English-speaking countries.
My mom and my dad, they make sure that we learn where they come from. My dad always said, even though you're born in the Bahamas, it's still your culture. So he will make sure us learn the Creole, but sometimes when we do speak too much Creole, he say go back in the English part. So then it'll be good for other people to learn the language, because to know the background where we from to appreciate us more.
And many more people will be able to learn Haitian Creole now that the Duolingo app is available. For The World, I'm Wilkin Brutus in Miami.
Dozens of members of Iraq's parliament were sworn in last week to replace those who walked out en masse last month. The walkout was in protest to deadlocked negotiations over forming a new government, and it allowed a party backed by Iran to take power of the parliament. Andrew Peake was a deputy assistant secretary for Iraq and Iran at the State Department. Now he's at the Atlantic Council, and he joins us. Andrew Peake, what's the significance for Iraq of this turnover of the majority in parliament?
This is the most important, high-profile, cataclysmic political event that nobody outside of the Middle East has ever heard of. What is happening in Iraq is basically Iraq's existing government that has existed in various forms since the American invasion, fighting against itself for who actually it represents. And it is a function of the protests that broke out in Iraq in 2019 that turned very violent, where essentially the million or so young people that Iraq is producing every year that are hitting the job market looked at the political system and said, this serves none of us. And this election, this political standoff, is really the fallout from those protests 2 years ago of people demanding change against an encrusted institution.
So are those millions of young people who were demanding change, is this the kind of change they wanted?
So, no, not exactly. The winner in the election that has produced this standoff is Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shia cleric. He's very much tried to position himself as an outsider to claim the mantle of those protesters. The problem is that Sadr himself is part of the system, so he can't effectively represent them, but what he can do is push back in real ways, including on the street, including in military ways, against Iran and those Iranian-backed parties that control the system.
Right, but now the parliament is full of politicians who are backed by Iran. So what can he do?
Right, so this was sort of the problem with ordering all of his deputies to step down, is that under Iraqi law, then the number two person steps up to fill the seat, and they are almost all representatives of the political umbrella headed by former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. So the immediate effect of his move is that the opposition gains a whole number of new seats in parliament. The catch is that they are not fully sworn in until the core, the parliament, reconvenes, and that's not for another month and a half or so. So there is this gap where they've stepped down, but they're not totally sworn out. So many people think that Sadr's playing this kind of political game, essentially bluffing the opposition into not wanting to take control of Iraq with their new majority in parliament during the summer months, at a time when Iraq is hot, doesn't have much power for AC, and Iraqis traditionally go to the streets and protest.
I think for a lot of our listeners, it's a confusing story. We've got Iraq, which we heard and talked about for years around the war, and then Iran now has this huge influence and presence there. What is Iraq's relationship with Iran at this point?
The cardinal sin of American policy in Iraq, I mean, there's many, there's no short list of these, but one of the big ones is never appreciating how much influence Iran would have in Iraq after the invasion. And properly speaking, Iraq is not a total puppet. It does have independence, but in two key ways, Iran wields tremendous amounts of influence. One is in those tactical activities that concern us and our allies most, us, the U.S., the proxies, the militias. Iraq is a breeding ground now for militias and the transit of missiles to the region. So that concerns us and our neighbors. The other is energy. You know, Iraq is obviously an incredibly energy-rich country, but it has to actually import gas and electricity from Iran at deleterious terms, at expensive prices, and to basically boost up the Iranian economy, and is prevented in a variety of ways from developing its own energy resources for internal consumption, partly because of political sclerosis, but also because of political pressure from Iran. So abnormal, but not fully a puppet.
So if the millions of young Iraqis don't want these kind of Iran-linked parliamentarians, who does?
This is a great question, and there's a couple of pieces to it. One is there are Iraqis who, for religious reasons or cultural reasons, just have a positive view towards Iran and vote for their sort of linked political parties. But the problem in Iraqi politics is that these parties are the armed ones, and thus they can distort their political influence. Because if you are an actor who is trying to form a government outside of Iranian influence, as Muqtada Sadr was doing, then as sure as God made green gravy, you will have some militiaman show up on your doorstep and threaten you with some kind of horrible thing. Really, the threat of individual consequences for voting against Iranian interests is very real, and these parties can enforce it.
So these new Iranian-backed parliamentarians who now make up the majority in the Iraqi parliament, they're not quite official. That will likely happen at the end of summer or fall. But does this very fact change the U.S. relationship with Iraq?
No, unfortunately. The thing that had the chance to change the U.S. relationship with Iraq was whether its old enemy, the U.S.'s old enemy, Muqtada al-Sadr, could form a government. That was what the great stakes in Iraq of the last 6 months were. And it's a little bit incredible for us who lived through the Sadr uprising in 2004 against American forces and who have been dealing with this guy for now 15 years as a militant Shia cleric. This was the great hope for building a normal relationship with Iraq, because while he doesn't like the U.S. and he wants less American influence in Iraq, he really doesn't want Iranian influence. And that was kind of what he was running on.
So, Andrew, what are U.S. policymakers watching for next?
Any change in those actions that concern us most. That can be the missiles that are getting trafficked through Iraq to Syria and Lebanon. It could be missiles that are being fired at U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And it's any change to the activities of militias in Iraq, not just against U.S. forces, but also against those Iraqis who want a better life.
Andrew Peak is with the Atlantic Council. He's been talking to us about Muqtada al-Sadr's withdrawal from Iraq's parliament and its impact on the politics of Iraq and the region. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
We're glad you're with us every weekday on the radio. You can also connect with us first thing each morning with our newsletter. Our digital editors curate the biggest international headlines of the day, plus stories you might have missed and a bit of good news to lighten your day. Our Top of the World newsletter hits your email inbox each weekday morning. Subscribe on our website, theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll be right back here tomorrow.
One last note before we go. The daily coverage you rely on from The World, whether it's the podcast, broadcast, or at theworld.org, it's available for everyone for free thanks to listener support. We're coming to the end of our fundraiser on June 30th. If you've been thinking about donating but just haven't done it yet, please make your gift today. It only takes a minute, but it helps our entire team to produce the show every day. Every single gift will help us reach our goal of raising $25,000. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.